Seattle's Morning News, good to have you tuned in this morning. A bill to decriminalize small amounts of drugs in Washington State has cleared its first hurdle. And with the update, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Supporters say what we've been doing clearly is not working. And the reason is decades of focusing more on locking drug users up than on helping them get treatment. This bill seeks to change that and more by doing away with the crimes of possession or use of small amounts of all drugs for personal use, then using the criminal justice savings and additional investment to really ramp up treatment options to not only ensure that those with substance use disorder can get the treatment they need as soon as they want it, but to make sure that there's a system in place to make sure they know how to get it. Democratic Representative and sponsor Lauren Davis telling the House Public Safety Committee how it would have made a big difference for a friend of hers that she helped deal with addiction.
There was one particular night that I will never forget. He couldn't find a vein and was growing increasingly frustrated. He would trace his bruised and swollen arms up and down, looking for a spot. He bent over and tried his foot, first the right, then the left. When that didn't work, he went into the bathroom, looked in the mirror, and puffed out his neck in an effort to inject there. After several hours of this, his arms, face, and legs were covered in blood. He began to weep. Tears streamed down his cheeks, and he whimpered, "I can't stop. I can't stop."
She says the bottom line is the criminal justice system only exacerbates the problem.
His suffering was deep and profound. His suffering was so many things, but it shouldn't have been illegal. He deserved help, not handcuffs. Substance use disorder is a response to trauma. The real question is not why the drugs, but why the pain. This disease is about not wanting to experience the present because it is too painful a place to be. When we arrest and incarcerate individuals, we only multiply the pain to be numbed. One of the diagnostic criteria for substance use disorder is continued use despite negative consequences. Therefore, it is implausible that imposing additional negative consequences through the criminal legal system will lead to a cessation of use.
Those who work in the treatment field also chiming in.
PATH program focus on folks who are living with mental health challenges. And at times, my clients also have substance use challenges. Once you throw a criminal charge on top of that, now we're talking major barriers with accessing services.
Incarceration is working that well for treating SUD and mental illness. We ought to think about locking people up for lung cancer.
And one of our own listeners shared her personal tragic story to make the point of how badly the change was needed.
He desperately wanted to get a job, but knew that getting hired with drug convictions on his record was unlikely. And how would he pay back the money he owed for court fines without employment? He couldn't find a way to get started on rebuilding his life. And that hopelessness and shame he felt made him vulnerable when his old using friends came knocking. After almost a year in recovery and overwhelmed by the long shadow of his past convictions, Ryan relapsed. He died of an overdose at Harborview Medical Center in July 2009.
Others with personal experience shared their story.
When I was between my junior and senior year of high school, I was taken advantage of by a classmate. I was blacked out from alcohol and he raped me. When I woke up because of what he was doing to me, I drove home drunk that night because I was too afraid that I would get in trouble with my parents if I was honest and asked them for help. It wasn't until I was in treatment at age 24 for heroin addiction after overdosing from a speedball, that's an injection of heroin mixed with cocaine, that I finally told them what had happened to me the night that I was raped. The reason I am here today, a leader in my community who has made significant change in my field is because I had the opportunity to get the resources and the help I need when I needed it most.
But others warned this proposal goes too far, including the Family Policy Institute.
We are concerned that this may lead to a change in public perception that these drugs are more acceptable.
And James McMahon with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs says,
"Let us make clear that Washington's sheriffs and police chiefs would actively support this bill if the provisions legalizing the possession of controlled substances were removed."
Snohomish County Prosecutor Adam Cornell worked hard to reverse his predecessor's policy of not prosecuting those busted with 2 grams or less of any drug. He offered this to the committee.
It is time to recognize that what we have been doing as a state to criminally address simple possession of a controlled substance is not and cannot work. It has not worked because we've not allocated sufficient resources and public goodwill toward those who are suffering from this disease. It has not worked because of the extraordinary punitive and collateral consequences of a felony conviction for simple possession. It has not worked because of its disproportionate impact on people of color. It has not worked because it has shamed many who are still who are ill and seeking treatment and preventing them from doing so. And it has not worked because it has not made our communities any more safe and livable. We need this bill to replace the criminal punishment with a promise of recovery by the allocation of resources, which I think everyone so far has agreed is absolutely necessary.
So, Hannah, is there anybody who thinks the present way of dealing with this is working?
I didn't hear anybody who chimed in and said that. What the concern is that this, the decriminalization aspect, is that this really does away with that crime. And that's where you're going to get the pushback. So the Family Policy Institute is the Family Policy Institute. And there was that concern from law enforcement, from the Washington Sheriff's Association of Police Chiefs. But as you've heard there, that was the Snohomish County prosecutor there at the end, Adam Cornell, who, again, worked very hard to reverse that policy where they were not prosecuting for 2 grams or less that his predecessor had. But he did that because he wanted to have that opportunity, that discretion, if you will, to offer treatment for those who are going to take it. And then, you know, for those who are just the repeats and coming back, go the other way. But you heard him there lobby very hard for this change because it wasn't working.
Well, that's the other thing. What we do now. That's the other thing. So for people then, so you put this in place, you offer the services, there are going to be those who say, no, leave me alone. So is there a provision for people who say that to say, I'm sorry, the new rule is you are going to get treated?
There's not anything specific. So what this would do would set up the state health care authority would have a year to do the rulemaking and meet some very specific guidelines. That what you're referencing is one of those where they'd have to make sure that they're dealing with, you know, you're not just having people repeat. Right. They'd have to come up whatever rule that's going to be. And they're going to have to come up with they need the continuum of care. They want to make sure there's no gaps where as soon as you get somebody and they go to treatment, you have expanded diversion, whatever it might be. They have to have this continuum of care. And that goes all the way through to housing and everything else. So this touches on a lot of things, and I don't have the specifics because it would have to be in rulemaking and depend on investment, which could come from some of the opioid lawsuit money, federal grants that we have for substance abuse that are available for the state. So there's a lot of possibilities here. Right now, this made it out of its first committee. It was voted out of committee and is going to appropriations. It'll need to clear there by next Monday in order to keep moving.
All right, it's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Joke points. And there were plenty of them over the last 4 days as drivers lost control all over the state during the snowstorm and all those grabby ruts on the road. Here's Chris with a look at the numbers.
Yeah, a listener texted me last week as we were trying to predict all the snow totals, and he told me that he couldn't wait for the snow. So I asked him why. Well, he works in an auto body shop, and he knows that snow equals dollars for his business, and I'm sure he's pretty full up right now with fender benders. Crashes over the weekend were up 300% as compared to a normal weekend. Just 2 weeks ago, they kind of compared and contrasted. 386 crashes alone in King County, 196 in Snohomish County. State Trooper Rick Johnson points to speed, overconfidence, and people who think their four-wheel drive can do everything.
People that have these all-wheel drive vehicles, and they think that they're invincible in a sense. You can get going, but ICE doesn't care if you have, you know, 42-wheel drive.
There he is again with our favorite 42-wheel drive car. So many crashes on I-90 yesterday that the state had to close Snoqualmie Pass. It is still closed right now because of the avalanche danger. It's closed from the truck stop in North Bend all the way to Ellensburg and coming back the other direction as well. State's going to reassess the danger at 8 a.m. Another, 12 inches of snow, I think what Nick is saying, was expected over the pass tonight, by later tonight, so it's going to be very dicey. Stevens Pass remains closed as well for avalanche control that's running a little late. It was supposed to wrap up at 6 a.m. So it looks like, again, we think we know what we're doing when we get to snow. And it turns out that it's usually speed and overconfidence that turns into the problems that
we happened to those tire socks? Remember when those things came out? They were supposed to help you get through the snow.
Tire socks are great, but you can only go a certain mile per hour in them before they just, because if you get out onto the real pavement after you've gotten off, they'll just shred. So you've got to use those. But those are a really good short-term thing, say, if you need to get out of your neighborhood. But when the ruts are, when, I mean, in our street, we had over a foot of snow. And I mean, my Toyota Corolla probably doesn't have the clearance if I were to drive it to get over the ruts.
This is just a major failing of technology to me. I mean, we've invented so many things. Why can't we invent a tire with retractable cleats? Right. So, you press, OK, cleats out when you're in the neighborhood and then cleats in when you're on the highway.
So like the Mach 5 from Speed Racer,
whatever.
I mean, that would be cool. I mean, I could also get a couple of saws on the front end in case I drive off road and I need to cut down the trees in front of me. That would be great.
We can now re-land rocket boosters. I would think we could at least figure out a way to drive in the snow.
Well, the thing is a lot of it has less to do with the car than it does to the person driver. Sitting behind the wheel.
Okay. I get that. Got this morning news from our off-the-radar department. There are still 2,500 American troops in Afghanistan. Under a Trump administration deal, all of them are supposed to be out in a little over 2 months. But then what happens? We called up CBS foreign affairs analyst Pamela Falk.
This is 20 years in and $1 trillion of U.S. dollars from the U.S. spent in Afghanistan, mainly on security. So the problem is with a May 1 deadline from the Trump administration signed U.S.-Taliban agreement, part of the question that the Biden administration has to deal with is with all this going on and increased violence and bombings as of this week and last week in Kabul and in other places, can you really pull all those troops out? And that's what you heard from Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, yesterday, and all of the defense ministers, including the United States, will meet on Wednesday and Thursday to figure out. What he said was there has to be a balance between not allowing Afghanistan to become the epicenter of terrorism,
right,
and trying to get troops out so that they can govern.
So, I mean, have we gotten rid of all the terrorists there? Of course, at this point, we have our own self-radicalization problem going on here. But, I mean, so we still have to worry about terrorist training in Afghanistan, too?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the regional affiliate of ISIS, the Islamic State group that targets minority Shiites, has grown. It's more brazen, more violent, and its attacks increase in frequency and audacity. You've got ISIS, you've got still Al-Qaeda, and then you've got this really strange development, which is the warlords have been co-opted by some international forces, some accused of war crimes, and the country has just become a center of crime. And so a new UN report basically looked at the crime and said that there's no proof, as I said, that Al-Qaeda militants have cut ties with the Taliban, and that the crime rates have gone so far high that no one can function in the country. And a January report last month by the U.S. Treasury found that the Taliban continues to cooperate with Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is getting stronger. So it's really a mess. It's the only way to describe it.
And all that money, I mean, I saw the statistics that the poverty rate in Afghanistan is 72%. 72% poverty rate. So even with all that money, people are still sitting around with nothing productive to do.
And, Dave, the issue is it's going up dramatically. That 72%, and you're right, went up from 55% in 2019. So two-thirds of Afghans live on less than $1.90 a day. Unemployment rose to almost 38% in 2020.
I thought we were going to build pipelines and roads and schools and things like that. Nothing worked.
No, I mean, the Taliban have allowed girls into school, which was part of the deal. But kids aren't going to school generally, so that's part of the problem. There's warlords, criminal gangs, now very corrupt government officials, and that's part of the big issue is that there's just not a way forward in terms of trying to develop what the U.S. was trying to develop for these two decades.
Hmm. So if we just leave them alone to deal with their own problems, will they leave us alone?
Apparently not. I mean, you know, we learned at 9/11, which is when is the beginning of this military engagement, that left alone, they can plot terrorist attacks for around the world. So that's exactly what the NATO Secretary General said yesterday. He said specifically, we saw on 9/11 what happens if you leave the country alone.
CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Falk at the UN. Thanks, Pamela.
Absolutely, Dave. Good talking.
Now, Hannah Scott joins us. There's a new plan to make sure that everybody gets a shot at getting a shot. Seattle's mayor has set a vaccination goal, and the governor wants more kids back in school. Here is Hannah's report.
Black and Hispanic communities have been disproportionately impacted by COVID, including the number of illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths. But they also are not getting vaccinated as quickly as Washington's white residents. State and local leaders have unveiled a new $15 million public-private partnership to help change that under a plan called All in Washington.
All in Washington works with our government partners to focus philanthropic giving to fill gaps not covered by public funding. And today our work continues as we take the next step in COVID-19 recovery to expand vaccine access in our hardest-hit communities. Systemic disparities have made it harder for many communities to stay healthy and safe throughout the pandemic, especially Black, Indigenous, and people of color, immigrants and refugees, and rural and remote communities.
Among the goals?
To help people have a desire to get the vaccine. This is obviously the first step, because people need to want the vaccine before they're going to get the vaccine. We're not going to be drafting people into this effort. We have a large role to play in that.
Governor Inslee says for the state's role.
And second, to provide people meaningful access in real terms, where they live, how they live, with their functionality, in a way to get access.
Jesus Fernandez is CEO at Family Health Centers in Okanagan.
Some of the barriers that are contributing to these disparities that we need to address are things like transportation, online access, language barriers, and frankly, addressing the fear that exists among communities because of either misinformation on social media or just lack of access to correct information. So a way to address those things is building capacity across systems and partners allows us to reach these populations where they live, where they work, where they come together, such as churches and other locations.
He says part of the problem is many of the Hispanic families in North Central Washington have always been very self-sufficient.
There's been historically a reliance and a tradition of relying on home remedies to address health issues and doing self-care. While that is normally a good thing, this is not enough to address this virus that we are facing. And so we need to help those folks understand that they can't rely on those kinds of self-care issues or practices when you're trying to fight this virus. We need actual health systems who have the science to address it correctly.
He says in some cases, Hispanic families have gone all the way back to Mexico to be treated, trusting that medical care more than ours. In Seattle?
In our region, the impacts on the Black community, the Indigenous community, and Latinx community is truly disproportionate. And many BIPOC and immigrant and refugee community members face already so many systemic barriers to vaccine access. Mobility barriers, language barriers, not being connected with the healthcare system, maybe being underinsured, and having a distrust of the medical system.
Mayor Jenny Durkin stressing just how important it is for all of us that these communities get access to the vaccine.
The fact of the matter is COVID-19 pandemic has hit these communities the hardest. And if we want to advance the next stage, we have to make sure that those communities have access to our vaccine efforts.
Durkin setting her own goal for Seattle to get to 70% of the population in her State of the City address last night. Later today, Governor Inslee will have more to say on the response to COVID-19 and is expected to offer an update on school testing programs and a return to in-person learning. He had this to say on education when he spoke on African American Legislative Day yesterday.
This has been a real challenge. When we started through this, we had very little knowledge of COVID, and our kids went into a remote learning environment. That was probably a good decision based on the information we have. But I think going forward, I'm hopeful that parents and students can be given options about how to move forward. I think some parents want to continue in the remote learning environment. I think many parents want to have their kids back at least partially in a in-school environment. maybe half time.
And
I'm really hopeful that we can give more students options in this regard. And the reason I say this is we have learned a lot about schools and COVID than we knew a year ago. And what we've learned is that if we do things smart, wear masks, distance, spread the kids out by having them only in the classroom half time, we've demonstrated we're able to do this in a safe way. This has been quite clear. We have about 200,000 students today who are having on-site learning.
Meantime, even though most of the state has only been in phase two for a couple of days, pressure is mounting from businesses and others to extend the governor's roadmap to recovery to include a phase three and get businesses working toward a goal of 50% capacity. Inslee's office says discussions are underway, but no specifics. House Speaker Lori Jenkins asked about the need to have a phase three on the board.
I think that what we should do is see what happens with the 25% opening. See if our disease rates increase, decrease, remain flat. And I think that's what will tell us whether or not a 50% reopening is the next thing to move to.
With her background in public health, Jenkins stressing,
I think that one of the things that is, again, continues to be of grave concern is when you have versions of the disease that are developing that are much more transmissible. And it looks like from information we're getting now, may have more serious consequences to them and may be harder on people when they get the disease. We have to be watching too to what kind of transmission is happening. Is it the Great Britain, you know, the Great Britain version, the South African version, the Brazilian version, right? We've got a lot of different things going on right now.
So, Hannah, back to the vaccine for a moment. I heard from a couple of different sources there in your report that there is a, in some cases, cultural aversion to taking this vaccine. So is it the government's business to tell people that they're wrong if they don't trust it?
I think a public awareness campaign is what they're trying to do and combat some of the misinformation that can be out there from social media, things like that. But then also it's a cultural thing, as you heard Jesus Hernandez say there, that there's a lot of reliance on home remedies, that maybe a lack of understanding about exactly what it is that they're dealing with. You know, there's stuff that's just simply not going to work. Those home remedies are not likely to work. So they want to really be able to go out and offer that public awareness and at least inform. But then also what this would do is allow them hopefully to raise this money to go directly to these communities and maybe talk one-on-one with some health professionals as they go out and interact with these communities and build that trust up is, I think, the idea.
And on schools, what's the teachers' union stand on fully reopening schools?
I believe this teachers' union stance is still not until every teacher is vaccinated. So we'll expect to hear more from the governor this afternoon. I don't expect that he's going to order, you know, everyone back into in-person learning, but I do expect that he'll have some sort of update, and I think an update on the school testing programs that they've got in place in the places where there is in-person learning going on right now.
So they're not impressed by the studies which show that it should be safe to reopen schools, huh?
Not that I've heard yet, and I'm sure we'll hear more from them this afternoon when the governor speaks.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
The Daily Dose of Kindness. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. I have a story in my file this morning. I read it at 7 o'clock in the newscast about Tacoma kindergartners going back to in-person learning, second graders about to join them too, and it warms my heart because all these months later, I'm starting to realize firsthand what it's like to be a kid stuck at home, trying to learn and navigate the urge to be with friends. My 7-year-old really, I don't know if I want to say struggling, but certainly showing signs of unrest, uneasiness, just wanting to get back to school and be with kids. So my heart was warmed to see a teacher in Ohio get some attention for how she welcomes her students back to the classroom each day, wearing a mask just like the kids. Monique Waters leads them in some daily affirmations. She shared the video on Instagram. Of course, it's picking up steam. So I thought I'd play it here, knowing that even some of us adults need a pep talk.
In her post, she writes, just remember to speak kindly to yourself. It just sets the tone for the day for the kids. But, oh, heck, I could use a pep talk like that every morning.
We can arrange that.
Yeah, you want to do it? You want to do daily affirmations, too?
Right at 6 a.m.?
Yes. Yes, you, we could each.
You lead it. You're the one to lead it.
I think we should each contribute one affirmation, right? We get to choose. Today, my affirmation is be kind. I'll start with the generic, and tomorrow I'll have a new one for you.
Okay. That should help. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. They're calling it the Great Valentine's Day Snow-In, followed by the President's Day Slushy. And we've all survived it both, or have you?
Well, first of all, I was wrong about the snow. Nick Allert tried to tell me that snow was coming, and I didn't believe
him. You didn't believe
him? No, I didn't. And, of course, I was wrong, but maybe I should go to school to be a meteorologist, so that didn't happen. So I was wrong about that. But the one thing I did do, I said, hey, you know what? Maybe the snow will come, so I got to make sure I get my Valentine's Day gifts out of the way. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing, though. Did Valentine's Day, did the whole thing, the gifts exchange and all that kind of stuff. But I got to tell you, I felt so insufficient on Valentine's Day. And here's why. When you open up social media and you see what everybody's doing, it's almost like people had professional photographers, videographers to help with this, with their plan, the pictures, the displays, the roses, the balloons. I'm like, wow. What?
You believe
if it makes you
that?
Feel any better, gee, we went grocery shopping on Valentine's Day with the kids, so don't worry about it.
But hold on, Dave. You say, do you believe all that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in my face, right? Huh. Like, everybody's like, I'm like, Valentine's Day is different now. It is like this amazing, I'm like, yo, my relationship is just ain't as cool as a lot of y'all's. It's just, you guys look great. You look
fantastic.
People
show the best of themselves on social media. I guarantee it's not always that way.
But I'm just saying, I'm just letting you guys know that on Sunday night, I went to bed thinking to myself, self, you got to step your game up.
So what are you going
to
do?
I'm going to hire a videographer next year. I'm going to hire a photographer, right? Absolutely. I'm going to hire some folks, and I'm just going to have all the looks, and then I'm going to post on social media,
it
and everybody's going to say,
more authentic than that.
Everybody's going to say, wow, whoa, look at that. How about you, Dave? What'd you do for Valentine's Day?
I gave her a card with a poem, some of my original poetry.
That's so sweet.
See, that's sweet. That's really nice.
You ready? Here we go. I have no roses that are red, nor violets that are blue, but what I like about our bed is sharing it with you.
Oh, huh? Huh? Shoot.
Isn't that nice?
I love that.
Isn't that
That's
sweet?
Really good.
So now, see,
if you're
going
to step it up, you better at least get to that level, G.
What?
And I didn't post that on Twitter, by the way.
See,
no.
But Dave, okay, wait, did you post a picture of the two of you?
No. Why would I do that?
You didn't
Nobody
post
else's
anything.
Business. It's none of anybody else's business.
But that's what it changed. It seems like that's what it was on Sunday.
I know.
It's Colin. Is it a Hallmark? Is it just a Hallmark holiday? What day is Valentine's Day to you?
It's a day to show all types of. I don't think it should just be about romantic love. I always do stuff for my kids as well. I cut out paper hearts and I leave a little trail of hearts for my kids, and I made them an almond cake and got them little gifts. You know, so I show love to friends, to my kids, to my romantic partner, to my parents. I think it should be a celebration of love for everyone, not just buy as much as you can to win Valentine's Day.
See, Colleen, that's because you do those your daily doses of kindness.
Well, I
day.
Try to walk the walk, you know, with the talk as well. Yeah. And I buy gifts throughout the year. I mean, that way the pressure is not on leading up to Valentine's Day, and you're not just buying to buy. You're actually going, hey, like I got my daughter a set of pajamas that are super soft because I knew she likes soft material, and I bought them like 3 months ago for Valentine's Day. So.
Mm-hmm. And so those chocolates from 1967.
Well, my husband told me not to buy him chocolate anymore. He'll eat the whole box. And
now, okay. Well, let me ask this: Do you guys think is it a good idea for me to go to my significant other and just say, "Hey, you know what? Let's just this whole February 14th. Let's just take off that day. Can we just come up with an
agreement?
Does
she want to take it off?
Sure. I don't know. I need to ask her.
Yeah, I mean, ask her that. If she likes Valentine's Day, then you should honor that since she's your partner. But if you don't want anything, you better mean it when you say it.
Is there a pressure? Is it a trap to even try it, Colleen?
I don't think so. You should be your authentic self in your relationship.
All right. That's right. Be your authentic self, G.
Yeah, Dave.
You have no problem doing that, G, so it should be no problem in your relationship. What'd you get her, by the way? You haven't shared that.
A card and some jewelry.
Jewelry?
Yeah.
Jewelry never loses.
And went out to, by the way, I went out to eat for the first time since March of last year on Sunday. Went out to dinner. That was the first time I've gone to dinner in a restaurant here.
So, and that was like a week after you said you wouldn't do that.
Yeah, sure was.
How was it?
See what you do for love?
I want to hear about that tomorrow.
Okay.
It's been so long since I've talked to somebody who actually went out dining somewhere. I feel I need to pump you for information.
All right, let's talk about that tomorrow.
All right.
All right,
guys. Gene Ursula, 9 o'clock, 100% authentic. And now we take you live to Washington, D.C., and David Farenthold at the Washington Post. David, the NAACP has announced its lawsuit against Donald Trump. This apparently has been building. I'm seeing some references to this, like, from December and earlier. So how far could this go?
Well, I'm really interested to follow that. There's so many different legal challenges going on with involving Trump, from the criminal investigations in Georgia and New York to lawsuits like this one. I mean, he's going to face a lot of legal bills, certainly, but I've covered so many attempts to hold Trump accountable through the legal system that have failed or have taken years and years. So I'm hesitant to put a lot of stock in any one of these right now.
The other development was that apparently QAnon is done. A guy named Ron Watkins, who is believed by a lot of people to be QAnon, put out an announcement on 8chan saying, you put up a good fight, but it's over. So what happens to the people who are so invested in this?
It's a great question, because they were so obviously invested in the idea that Trump could never lose, that he was secretly orchestrating all of this, that, Biden was never going to take office. Trump was, always going to swoop in and establish a dictatorship. That didn't happen. So there's been sort of a splintering. I think some people have maybe stepped back and said, well, maybe it was all a lie, which it was. Other people, there's one theory that, yes, Trump is not the president now, but he's going to be president on March the 4th, which is the traditional.
That's still active?
That's still active. That's the day that presidents were inaugurated a few decades ago. Trump's hotel is sold out in D.C. for that day. So I think some people are coming back. I don't think Trump is doing anything to promote that, but some of these QAnon people are. Some of them have gotten really interested in the coup in Myanmar because they're just into coups now. You know, there's people who have invested a lot of time in this and then aren't going to give up. I don't think there's really going to be an end to this until the pandemic is over and people can go back to the real world and stop falling down in these rabbit holes.
Yeah. That fence is still up around the Capitol, I assume. It's just going to be there for the time, for the foreseeable future or what?
I mean, at this point, it does. It seems like that, yes. I think it will be up there for a while. You know, because of the pandemic, there's not a lot of, tourist demand to go in the Capitol for now. I think when that comes back, I think the fence will go away, but we will see a much more... You know, I bet the Capitol Police budget will triple. You know, I bet we'll see more physical barriers there, but probably not a big, ugly fence like right now.
Yeah. Nancy Pelosi's investigation, the Democrats have the power to greenlight that on their own, correct?
That's right. And she's talking about a 9/11 style commission investigation for this for January 6th, which is great because the Trump impeachment trial, because of the way the Democrats ran it, didn't really serve as that kind of broad fact-finding inquiry. It was a much more narrow inquiry. So, we don't really know what's going to come out of the criminal investigation. So if anybody's going to tell us the full story, it's going to be this commission.
Well, I can't imagine the Republicans would oppose it because they spent most of the impeachment trial demanding an investigation. So this would have to go ahead, even from their point of view, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I sort of thought of the Trump's arguments in all these different legal cases while he was president, which was that, like, you can't sue me while I'm president and you can't sue me after I'm president either. Like, just the Republicans are saying, well, you can't investigate him during an impeachment, or you didn't investigate him, so we can't impeach him. But I'm sure after they didn't impeach him, they'll say you can't investigate him because he's not president anymore. Yeah. And there'll never be a good time for them.
Yeah. I especially feel sad for you because you've been wanting his tax returns for so long now. Do you think that you are finally going to get a look at them?
Yeah, I do actually. I mean, I don't think it's 100%, but between the House Ways and Means request for them and the New York Attorney General's or the Manhattan DA's investigation seeking them, I think we will see at least some of them. I don't think they'll stay hidden forever.
And you're still expecting to find, well, I mean, what? I mean, obviously you don't know, but I mean, what? There must be a reason that you've lusted after them for 5 years now.
Well, you know, I don't know if we'll find anything criminal in there or not, but it certainly would show us more of the reality behind his business boasting. And I'd like to know more about the state of the Trump Organization now and how much money it's losing. We might see that. And we might see a little bit more about his fight with the IRS, you know, the $72 million refund that he got in 2009. Now may have to give back. We might learn a little bit more about what stage that is at.
Right. In terms of his involvement in politics, of course, he's free now to get involved again. But the most of the talk, apparently, is about Lara Trump, who is Eric's wife, because she's from North Carolina, and Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina voted to convict, which means he can expect a challenge. And it sounds like everybody thinks that Lara is a shoo-in.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think people, you know, want to be really sure about something that's going to happen in 2 years. Lara Trump's, you know, not a politician, she's never run for office before. You know, she's trading on the Trump name in a state where Trump has won, but she's also running against the guy, Richard Burr, who has been running a lot longer than she has and is a pretty well-established brand in North Carolina. So, you know, to me, the prospect that, like, just because somebody's got Trump in front of their name, especially if they're not an established politician, I don't see it as a guarantee they'll get elected, even in a Trump state, 2 years or 4 years from now.
And so what is the brand now, or what is the philosophy, I guess, of Trumpism? What would she be selling?
that's the crazy thing about it, is it became so much at the end just about Donald Trump. You know, it's like the ideas of the Republican Party, that this was their platform, was just what Donald Trump said. And he, of course, said different things from day to day. But I imagine there would be some, you know, focus on immigration, trying to reduce immigration, mm-hmm. promises to bring American jobs. So, I mean, a lot of the stuff that Trump promised in 2016 and largely didn't do. You know, I think Trumpism is often just sort of a political style. I mean, look at Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia. She doesn't really have a lot of ideas or policy prescriptions. She's not like the Tea Party, where she's calling for cutting spending. She just, you know, hates liberals and wants to make them mad. And that's enough for some people. So, you know, Laura Trump might try to run on that kind of culture war sentiment rather mm-hmm. than any particular ideas.
The whole thing about immigration, which got this started, is it fair to say he did not deliver on that?
Well, he reduced immigration overall, and he built a lot of he built lots of wall along the U.S. border. So there, he definitely changed the immigration system. I think one of the things you saw, though, was that immigration was never that important to folks. Like, it wasn't like people celebrated Trump's changes in immigration when they voted. You know, I think the thing that people cared about with Trump was the economy. So I guess Trump did make a lot of changes in the immigration system. Most of them are being undone by Joe Biden. Trump didn't find sort of a new solution that worked. He just, you know, sort of just yeah. turned all the knobs down to zero.
Yeah. What I've found is some of the Trump supporters I've corresponded with on and off is that even though they wanted some sort of immigration reform, they were happy to hire undocumented immigrants without
like
asking about their socials, without asking or demanding legitimate Social Security numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we didn't really see a huge impact. You know, remember in Alabama and Arizona when they had those really tough anti-immigration laws, yeah. a lot of migrant workers just left and the economy suffered. I don't think Trump was in office long enough to make that kind of impact around the country in the U.S. If somebody came in, if he got back in or somebody else made those changes for the long term, we'd have to replace those migrant workers somehow, you know, and I don't think anybody figured out the answer to that.
By the way, Mitch McConnell's basic torching of Trump after the impeachment verdict, does he get called on the carpet for that? Because he is the carpet. I mean, what happens to him?
I don't think much happens to him. He's not dependent on Trump's favor the way that Kevin McCarthy is in the House. You know, this. I think there are a lot of members of the Senate. I mean, 7 voted to convict Donald Trump, Republicans, and a lot more, I think, would be happy if he stepped off the stage, just because they have to run statewide. A lot of them are much more vulnerable than House members. So I don't think McConnell will face much consequences. I guess the question is, does Trump really rebound? Does he become a major political figure, a candidate again in his own right? Or does he stay what he is now, which is kind of this invisible figure issuing, instead of punchy tweets, like long, turgid press releases from Mar-a-Lago? If he stays that, I think Mitch McConnell may have a chance to remake a Republican Party without Trump.
David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. Thanks, David. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.